Hey, this is Rich Wilkerson. I'm the pastor of VU Church in Miami, Florida, and this is our podcast. Thank you so much for checking it out today. I hope it encourages you and inspires you. Here's today's message.
This is going to be a good day. I'm excited to be here. We're in this collection through the book of Hebrews. We've been studying this book. It's week three. If you didn't get a journal, we have some left at the resource corner. You can pick them up for a small fee. But our team put together this awesome thing we call the Hebrews Creed. And it's like this collection of power statements drawn from these 13 chapters of this book, this letter. And we've been saying it together. So it's going to get weird right away. So let's just, I'm going to count to three, and then we're going to say this together. It's called the Hebrews Creed. You ready? One, two, three. I live by faith and not by sight. The Lord is my helper, so I will have no fear. Since Jesus has gone through suffering and testing, he is able to help me when I'm being tested. I hold tightly to the hope of God's promise for my life. I encourage my brothers and sisters to do the same. I run the race God has set before me, and I'm not going back. Come on, one more time. Why don't you make some noise? I love it. You guys sound good. I'm going to take the next few moments we have together to talk to you from this theme. I'm not letting go. I'm not letting go. Could you turn to right, your left? Say hi. Maybe three people. Tell them I'm not letting go as you grab your seat. I'm not letting go. I'm not letting go. I'm not letting. I'm still not over it, and I'm not letting go. How are we feeling? You guys, good. Good to see you on this Sunday in summer. If you didn't know that each summer here at VU, we take some time to walk through a book of the Bible together. And we've been studying this letter we call Hebrews. Hebrews, we discovered over the past 2 weeks, is a letter written to Jewish Christians somewhere in like the 60s AD. So this ancient letter. And maybe right away that phrase sticks out to you, seems odd, Jewish Christians. Like, is that a thing? Or, I thought you're either Jewish or you're a Christian. Well, these people, the Hebrews, they believed that Jesus wasn't a new thing. He wasn't an add-on. He wasn't a departure. He was actually the fulfillment of their faith. They believed he was the thing they had been waiting for their entire lives. But the challenge for them was that it wasn't easy to be a Christian. Because even though they thought that they were still being Jewish, a lot of their friends and family and neighbors disagreed. And so often they were isolated or ostracized or cut off from the people they loved the most. And it was not an easy thing. It's hard for us to fully like understand or appreciate their society because they didn't have this thing called separation of church and state. To them, it was all mixed up together. So their daily lives were wrapped up in being Jewish. In their faith, it was not only what they believed, it was who they were. So, you know, at a deep level, it was central to their identity. But then at a practical level, it was like central to society. So their daily life was affected by what they believed. And it was not an easy thing to believe differently. And on top of that, it wasn't easy, but also it wasn't really cool yet. So if you wait a couple hundred years, it'd be all the rage when Constantine decided this is the official religion of the Roman Empire in the 4th century. But before then, it was kind of this odd offshoot of Judaism and like what exactly is it? It was called the Way at the time. And then it started to be perceived as a threat by the Roman Empire. And then all of a sudden, a Christian became a very dangerous thing to be. And people started losing their lives for their faith. So it wasn't easy, and it wasn't cool. And the question they started asking, I think the question for us today in 2019, especially if you're American and especially if you're a millennial, is if it's not easy and it's not cool, why on earth would I want to be a part of it? Why should we be Christians? That was the question that these first century Jewish people were asking themselves, like, is following Jesus really worth it? What's it going to cost me, and is it a price that I'm willing to pay? And I wanted to ask you like this today, what do you do when your belief no longer makes your life better? What do you do with that when maybe you make a decision or you take a stand, and all of a sudden things don't get better, they get worse? Life doesn't get easier, it gets harder. And I think a huge challenge for us today is that we've been sold this like off-brand version of Christianity that says pray your problems away and like believe the bad things away, tithe your troubles away, and whatever you ask for, you get. And it's just not true. It's not how it works. Maybe you grew up in a Christian home and now you're 25 and you live in Miami and you're starting to wonder, like, is it still serving me? Like, is it still something that I should do? Maybe you feel like your faith is holding you back, like in your dating life. Because you got these things, they're called standards. And you're going, man, if I didn't have these, I could just do whatever with whoever, whenever, and it'd be a whole lot easier. Maybe you feel like it's holding you back on the weekends because you got this thing, it's called conviction. And you're going, man, it would be a whole lot easier if I didn't feel bad and feel guilty. I could just enjoy my life and do what everybody else is doing. We said it last week, going against the grain, going against the current, going against the culture brings resistance. And maybe it's just wearing you out. I'm tired of swimming upstream. It'd be a whole lot easier if I could just let go and just be carried along with everybody else. Is it really worth it being a Christian? Is it really worth the cost? Maybe you're considering like, you know what if I just like cut out all the religious stuff and I just like kept all the inspiring practical stuff? Like just the good quotes and stuff. Like what if I kept like do unto others as you would have them do unto you? Everybody loves that. But what if I, maybe I'd just leave out like to live as Christ, to die as gain. Like that's a little bit extreme. I don't know if I want to be part of that, you know? Maybe what if I just kept like the Psalms and the Proverbs and the parables of Jesus and I just cut out like Leviticus and Deuteronomy and the letters of Paul and the letters of Peter and the letters of James. What if I just kept all the good stuff and cut out all the hard stuff? Is it really worth the price that I have to pay? Is it worth it to be a Christian? This is where the early Jewish Christians found themselves in the tension between options. Do I keep going forward with the hard thing or do I just go back to the easy thing? Do I just do what everybody else is doing? And I think that's where we find ourselves today. You know what? I actually do believe that like being a Christian will make your life better. I just think you got to define better. Because in 2019, better might mean easier, cooler, more convenient. I when I say better, I just mean better. Like of superior quality, of greater excellence, better. I made a lot of defining in this message. Can I just be honest? Like, Christianity won't make your life easier, but it'll make it better. It won't make your life more convenient, but it'll just make it better. It may not make your life cooler. I don't know, I mean, it's pretty cool, if you come here. But regardless, it's gonna make it better. Is it really worth it? Is it worth it? Is it worth it? And I wrote it this way, Christianity, it's not gonna make your life cost nothing. It's just gonna make your life worth something. This may be your first time in church, but you don't need divine revelation to understand the principle. Everything that is worth something costs something. There's no value without a price. And so for God, a relationship with you is worth everything. The question is, what is it worth to you? He was willing to pay the ultimate price. What price are you willing to pay? This is where these people found themselves and they were wondering, is it really worth it or should I just let it go and go back? So this like anonymous writer of Hebrews, they sit down to answer the question, why even be a Christian at all? And that's where we go to the text, Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14. He says, therefore, or she, in light, we see this word a lot in Hebrews, like in light of everything that's come before and everything that's gonna be stated, like in Hebrews chapter 1, Hebrews 2, Hebrews 3, therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. Now, I see two big things that the writer's gonna encourage us to do in our text today. The first thing is he's telling us we gotta hold firmly to faith. Hold firmly to faith. I love film. Now, there are levels of pretentiousness when it comes to talking about film. And it's really easy to figure out which level you're working with someone, because it's all about the language. So like, the lowest level, the least pretentious, is people who talk about movies. This is most of us. Most of you, I should say. Second level is people who talk about film. I'm in this category. The third level, the highest, the most pretentious, people want to talk about pictures. Now, that doesn't even feel familiar. People don't even really say that. It's a small category of people. So I'm only mildly pretentious, so I go for films. Now, we all have our own tastes in movies, except for the occasional freak who doesn't like any of them. It's a specific example, but it's an inside joke. It's fine. We all have our own taste, but, you know, I have a pretty refined taste, and I run the risk of losing you guys. Just keep up if you can. But when I was reading Hebrews chapter 4, I was just reminded of this classic American film. It's really like a morality play more than a movie. Like, it's a tale about the age-old dichotomy between good and evil. It's that Hegelian dialectic of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. It's like, it's a tale as old as time. It's not Beauty and the Beast. Classic American film, you may have heard of it. It is called Dodgeball. 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 Five D's of dodgeball. Richie, is that what it's about? So Dodgeball, the subtitle is a true underdog story. And it sets the protagonist, Peter LaFleur, played by Vince Vaughn, phenomenal actor. And he's set up against his diminutive nemesis, the ironically named White Goodman, played by Ben Stiller. And Ben Stiller, he owns this chain of gyms called Globo Gym, and he wants to acquire Average Joe's. And so he hires a lawyer, and he wants to impress his lawyer. She turns out to be a beautiful woman, and so he invites her to his office. And when she comes in, he pretends to be reading the dictionary and pretends to be surprised that she's there. And she's like, "You set up the appointment. You knew I was coming. You asked me to be here." And they start talking, and it contains one of my favorite comedic lines of all time, okay? And I just had to share it with you. And so she says, they start talking, and she's distracted by this painting that's on the wall behind him. And so she's like, "Hey, rather than describe it to you, I'm just going to show it to you. This is the painting that's on the wall of White Goodman's office. Take it in. I'll tell you a lot about the character if you haven't seen Dodgeball yet. This is the painting." And she sees it, and she goes, "Well, that's a very, that's an interesting painting." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, thank you. It's, that's me taking the bull by the horns. It's how I like to do my business. It's metaphor." And she goes, yeah, no, I get it. And he goes, he pauses, and he goes, "But that actually happened." And it's just so funny to me, because it's like, as if this painting on the wall of his office is like both a metaphor for how he does business and also a record of an actual event in which he subdued a bull by taking it by the horns. And it's so stupid, and I think it's so great. And it reminds me of Hebrews chapter 4. What are we talking about? So, because what happened is I was reading it this week, and I read this phrase. He says, "We have a great high priest, Jesus, the Son of God, who ascended to heaven." Yeah. And I thought when I read it, like, oh, yeah, like that's a metaphor for like how we relate to God. Like Jesus, he goes to God on our behalf, and he acts as a high priest. He advocates for us. He's on our side. And then I paused, and I realized, like, but that actually happened. Wow. So, like, the writer is not just using a literary device. They're referencing a historical event. We're talking about why you should be a Christian. And he says, we have a high priest, Jesus, who ascended to heaven. Like, oh, yeah, like he goes to God for us. No. Like, we stood in a field, and like he like lifted off the ground, and he floated into the sky. Like, it's wild. I know it sounds crazy, but like, let's not forget what Christians believe. We believe that like Jesus came to earth. He claimed to be God. He predicted his own death and resurrection. If you can pull that off, I'm with you. He died. He rose again. He was seen by witnesses. and then he ascended into heaven. Like, what the writer's saying is, like, the foundation of your faith is not just an idea. It's not just a metaphor. It's not just even a belief. It's an event. Why do we believe? Because something happened. The resurrection of Jesus is the foundation of our faith. That's what we cling to. That's what we hold to. That's what we believe. We have a great high priest who has ascended to heaven. Why should we believe? Because Jesus is alive. That is the only reason to be a Christian. So, like, if Jesus is alive, you should be a Christian. And if Jesus isn't alive, you shouldn't. And so these people who are wondering, like, should I still hold to my faith even though life is getting hard and times are tough and I might actually lose my life? He's saying, why should you hold to faith when it's hard, when it's inconvenient, when it's not cool? Because something happened. You should hold to your faith because Jesus is alive. That is the foundation. Why should we hold to our faith? Because it's true. Remember that old concept? Truth. True and false. See, we live in a world that wants to do away with true and false and wants to replace it with true and true. True for me, true for you. It's not right or wrong, it's just a matter of perspective. I respect your perspective, I just feel differently. There's no such thing as right or wrong, it's just different. It's a matter of opinion, and I'm sorry to break it to you, like 19-year-old, 25-year-old, 58-year-old, like it doesn't really, it's not an age thing, it's a perspective thing. Because whoever told you that you can have whatever you want in this world was wrong. You were born into a world with limitations, and one of the limitations is some things are true, some things are not. Some things are real, some things are fake. There's this thing, it's called right and wrong. Not I just feel differently, but wrong. And don't get me wrong, like, I actually think you should challenge the status quo. So I'm not saying that you should, like, think everything. We should think the same thing that we used to think. I'm not saying we should do everything we used to do. I'm not saying even that we should believe everything we used to believe. I think it's really dangerous to cling too tightly to what you think is true, because you could always be wrong. So there's a level of openness, but at the same time, if you don't like reality, you can't just reinvent it. If you don't like history, you can't just rewrite it. If you don't like the truth, you can't just twist it. You can make something up and choose to believe it, but it'll never make it true. There's this thing. It's called right and wrong. It's called true and false. And the writer, he's encouraging these people who had already decided what they believed. They had already decided to put their faith in Jesus, but they're considering giving it up because times were tough. And he's reminding them, like, hold firmly to your faith. And what we learn about faith is that, like, if you don't hold on to it, you won't keep it. It's actually not good enough to have faith. You've got to hold on to it. It's not good enough to become a Christian. You have to stay a Christian. It's not those who go the hardest, it's those who go the longest. You got to go the distance. So you might have faith, but the question is, can you hold on to it? We got to remind ourselves of what we believe and why. And I think that this is, like, a huge part of why church matters. Not just the Sunday gathering, but, like, all of it. Crew and hanging in the courtyard and being on a team and service projects and VU Girl and VU Conference. Every single time we gather, we are reminding ourselves who we are, who God is, what we believe, why we believe it, why we should stand firm. It's hard to stand firm alone. It's hard to encourage yourself. Every time that we gather is an opportunity to remind ourselves, to encourage each other. And the writer of Hebrews, he's going to reference this a little way down the line. You'll read in your journals in a couple weeks, Hebrews chapter 10. He says, do not forsake the gathering. Don't forsake the assembling. Don't give up on getting together. And he uses this phrase I love. He says, but let us consider how we may spur each other on. I like that phrase, spur each other on. Do you know what a spur is? I don't like I didn't grow up like around horses, but like a spur is a sharp thing that goes on the heel of a boot of a rider of a horse. It's a lot of prepositions, but you get like, so there's a spur on the heels, and when you're riding a horse and it stops and it refuses to go forward, you dig the spurs in, and that little bit of discomfort, that little bit of pain keeps the horse moving forward. It's not always comfortable to be spurred on, but we need it. We need someone who's going to encourage us and challenge us and correct our thinking. Say, you're better than that. There's more inside of you. God's doing something. Don't give up. Hold firmly to your faith. We all need to be spurred on. We all need to be encouraged. Sometimes I need to be made a little bit uncomfortable. For some of us, this is the problem is, you know, I came to church and it made me uncomfortable, so I left. You free? That's part of the point. No one's mad at you if that's your story, but I think you're missing out because you need to be spurred on. You need to be made uncomfortable because it's not very comfortable growing. It's not very comfortable changing. It's not very comfortable learning. It's not very comfortable being challenged and being corrected. It's not always comfortable, but your comfort is not the most important thing. You've got to keep moving. And so you need people who will spur you on. The writer says, hold firmly to your faith. I don't know about you. Like, I want to keep my faith. So I'm going to have to learn how to hold on to it. Hold firmly to faith. And then he goes on in verse 15. He says this. He says, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Wow. The first thing the writer tells us to do is to hold firmly to faith. The second thing I see is that he tells us to go boldly to God. Hold firmly to faith and go boldly to God. Why can we hold firmly to faith? Because Jesus is alive. Why can we go boldly to God? Because Jesus is our advocate. The writer, he calls Jesus our high priest. And remember, he's writing to Jewish people. So what he's doing is he's referencing a system that they've grown up in their entire lives. The system in which one person is chosen, is assigned to go to God on the behalf of everyone else. And like year after year, the priest would go with offerings and sacrifices to make atonement for sin. That's a lot of like Bible terms, but the idea is pretty simple. God had given the Jewish people a standard. The standard was called the law. And time again, they fell short of the standard. That falling short, what we call sin, created a separation between people and God. And so the priests were assigned temporarily and imperfectly to stand in the gap between God and man. Now, you and I, we find ourselves in a similar situation today. The context is different, but the idea is the same. God has a standard. Call it what you will. Call it morality. Call it right and wrong. But it comes from the character and the nature of who God is. And when we don't line up, when we fall short of the standard, we create a separation between ourselves and God. And so we need someone to stand in the gap between us and God. But the good news for you today is that that's already been done. You see, Jesus, he is our great high priest. He goes to God on our behalf. You see, they had an average high priest, but we have a great high priest. You see, the great high priest, year after year, century after century, would go to God with the same old sacrifices and offerings and petitions and pleas, and he would never solve the problem. Oh, but the great high priest, he made one sacrifice once and for all, and his work is finished. You see, the average high priest, he understood the weakness of man, but he failed to understand the greatness of God. You see, the text says that we have a high priest who empathizes with our weakness. He empathizes. Empathy is the ability to understand or feel what someone else is experiencing from within their frame of reference. This is why Jesus had to come from heaven to earth, because he wanted to understand you from your frame of reference. The problem with the Old Testament priests is that they knew human weakness a little bit too well. They were just as bad as the people they were advocating for. They needed mercy just as much as the people they were pleading for. But Jesus, he's not an average high priest, he's a great high priest. He's not an average high priest, he's a great high priest. You see, the average high priest, he understood the weakness of man, but he fell short of the greatness of God. The great high priest, he understands the depths of man's depravity and the heights of God's glory. See, the average high priest, he spoke from earthly experience, but he knew no heavenly wisdom. The great high priest, he came from heaven to earth to discover the ways of man and to disclose the ways of God. But best of all, the average high priest had to kill to cover his sins. The great high priest died to cancel yours. Come on, is anybody grateful that Jesus is our high priest? He's not average. He's a great high priest. I love how the writer says it in the Message translation, Hebrews chapter 10. Every priest goes to work at the altar each day, offers the same old sacrifices year in, year out, never makes a dent in the sin problem. As a priest, Christ made a single sacrifice for sins, and that was it. Then he sat down because he was done, right beside God, and waited for his enemies to cave in. It was a perfect sacrifice made by a perfect person to perfect some very imperfect people. And because by that single offering, he did everything that needed to be done for everyone who takes part in the purifying process. See, Jesus, he did everything that needed to be done for you. But this is where we kind of take a turn. Because he didn't do everything that needed to be done by you. So Jesus said, it is finished, but that meant his work was done. But where the work of Jesus ends, that's where your work and my work begins. Now we have been invited into the process. Don't you just love the process? I don't know, but when I go to sleep, I dream about the process. It's like, don't even give me the meal. Just let me cook the food. Don't even give me the abs. Just let me do the workout. Don't even give me the knowledge, just let me take the class. Don't even give me the money, just let me do the job. Don't even give me the love, just let me raise the kids. I just love the process. It's like, it reminds me of all the songs and all the movies about the process of maintaining a healthy marriage. You've heard them, you've seen them. Is it? No one raves about the process. No one celebrates the process except for hipsters with their coffee. We get it, man. Just give me the product. I don't want to go through the process. But you see, Jesus went through his process. It's called justification. And the result is your forgiveness. Now you're invited into your process. It's called purification. And the result is godliness. So he went through his process. Now you need to go through yours. Just because you've been forgiven does not mean you're godly. Someone said amen. It's like, my sister's been a Christian for 10 years. She's still mean. These are different processes. And when we mix them up, we get messed up. I wrote it down this way this week. The gospel, we confuse it. It's not the end of work. It's the end of merit. See, merit means being worthy. Merit means being good enough. Work just means work. So you don't have to work for your worth, but you got to go to work. You don't have to do it all, but you got to do something. We don't work to be right with God. We work to be like God. We don't work our way to God. We already have access. We work our way to godliness. In fact, we don't work our way to God. We walk our way to God. Picture it this way, like the sin of humanity had created a chasm or a gap between God and man. So Jesus, he came from heaven to earth and he bridged the gap. The thing about a bridge, though, is that it doesn't do you any good unless you walk across it. So you have access to God, but you got to go to God. So we hold firmly to faith. That's what Jesus has done for us. And we go boldly to God. That's what we now have access to do. We can go to God boldly and with confidence. Jesus, he made a way to God. Now you got to make your way to God. He says, hold firmly to faith. He says, go boldly to God. So what? So that we can receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Christianity is not the end of work, and it's not the end of need. Becoming a Christian doesn't mean you'll never need anything again. Becoming a Christian just means that you know where to go when you need something. And we can go to God confidently because of what Jesus has done, and we will receive what we need. Not what we're praying for necessarily, not necessarily what we think we need, but we're going to receive two things that we desperately need, whether we know it or not: mercy and grace. Mercy and grace. See, what I realized about faith is that if you don't hold on to it, you won't keep it. But what I realized about mercy and grace is that if you don't go for it, you won't get it. That's the work of a Christian. It's not the work of forgiveness. It's not the work of worth. It's not the work of merit. It's the work of faith, holding firmly to the faith that you've professed and going boldly to God, going to God full of confidence. Somebody say confidence. Confidence is the feeling that you can rely on someone. Even the definition will preach. You don't go to God with confidence because of how good you are. You go to God with confidence because of how good he is. You go to God knowing I can rely on him. I got a feeling, I got a sense that he's gonna come through, that he's gonna follow through on his promise. His promise is that you'll receive mercy and grace. I love, it says, let us then approach God. This tells me two quick things. First of all, we don't go to God on our own. We go to God with others. It says, let us approach God. That's what we're doing today. It's easier together. It's hard to stand firm alone. But it also says, let us then, which means we don't go to God in our own time. We go to God in order. Like there's a rhythm to it. There's a timing to it. Let us go then. When? When we have fully come to appreciate and experience that Jesus is our high priest. You see, it's not until you can appreciate and understand the work that Jesus has done for you that you can do your work that he's called you to. You see, you'll never have confidence in your work if you don't have confidence in his work. So you have to start with the gospel. You have to start with his work. You got to start with what he's done for you. But you can't stop there. Because the gospel is not the end of work. It's the end of merit. And I love this promise that as we go to God, we receive what we desperately need, which is mercy and grace. Because in saying so little, it says so much. You see, mercy is the unmerited forgiveness of God. But grace is the unmerited favor of God. See, mercy, it's withholding all the bad that you do deserve. But grace is giving all the good that you don't deserve. The promise of Jesus is mercy and grace. I don't know if you understand it today. Like, mercy says, I'm not against you. Grace says, I'm for you. Mercy says, I accept you. Grace says, I approve of you. Mercy says, I won't punish you. Grace says, I'm gonna bless you. Mercy says, we're no longer enemies. Grace says, let's be friends. Mercy says, I won't drive you away. Grace says, I wanna draw you close. Mercy says, I don't hate you. Grace says, I love you. Mercy says there's forgiveness for your past, but grace says there is favor for your future. I don't know about you, but I am so grateful that we serve a God who is not only merciful, he is gracious. Come on, if we will hold firmly to faith and we will go boldly to God.
Well, thanks again for listening. To hear more messages like this one, make sure to subscribe and check out our podcast channel for past episodes. And if you like what you're hearing, consider rating it and even sharing it with friends. It helps so much. For more content from VU and to connect with us, go to VUchurch.com. We love you. The best is yet to come.